wife or husband. Why are you so great to me? Why are you so kind of job? In other words, not to be tied to what we say the job of the father, not to be tied to the place where your parents live, not to be tied to their choice of a husband or wife for you. You can say that in the West, these basic needs have become basic rights, but there is much struggle in many other parts of the world to realize them. So I find them very often, but I use them here as examples. The concept is richer than them. And then you have identity, and of course one way of defining identity is not only to be alive, not only to have something to live for, not only to have choices, but to have something to live for, some kind of meaning with life. And the most elementary one is your own ego, your own egocentric, egoistic satisfaction. And here you see, it's impossible not to pay attention that this is the basic doctrine of economics. That if everybody behaves according to egoism, satisfaction of own wishes, then that will lead to the satisfaction for everybody, from egoism to altruism. I think it's on the basic and the most horrible lies perpetrated on humankind by Adam Smith. And there are many people who say that what the science of economics consists in is to try to prove that this is correct. And of course, the intermediary is the market system. So here we ended up very clearly in the critique of economics. And I can tell you what I live for. I live for peace. P-E-A-C-E. In other words, to have a goal, something, if you will, larger than yourself, that you hang on to. And in the Hinduism, they have an expression for it. In Hindi, it's called Tatvam Asi, that out there, that links to something in here, in your brain, in your heart. That out there linked to something that in here. That particular expression is from my co-author Graham McQueen, a brilliant Canadian. We wrote the book Globalizing God together. So I just want to do justice to him by quoting him. So here, you see, are the guidelines I use to make the category needs more precise. Two needs for nature, four needs for humans. Well, they have served me very well. I am totally aware that they can become better. I'm sure others can come up with better lists. I can only say that so far I haven't seen that better list. Let me finish by saying one thing. You see, epistemologically, logically too, thinking, if you want to understand the concept, ask what is the opposite of this concept. Opposite, negation. You want to understand what a man is about? Ask what a woman is about. You want to understand the new world as it was discovered, quote unquote, from 1492 on? Try to understand it in terms of the old world. You want to understand survival? Well, the opposite is death. What is the opposite of wellness? It's illness. You see, if you don't get your food, your water, and you're exposed to the climate because you're not protected by clothing and housing, and so on, it shows up as illness. And one type of illness is that you're unable to communicate because you haven't had education. By education, I don't mean schooling. I mean parents talking to you, for instance, correcting and being amazed at how quickly, already at 2 years old, that young baby, former young baby, is able to talk. Walk at one, talk at two, is the general rule, if you will. Now, what is the opposite of freedom? It's repression. And what's the opposite of identity? Alienation. That you're alienated from yourself. Maybe somebody has put somebody else's goals into you, and if that's a colonizing power, it's often called internal colonization. And you find a lot of that in the former colonies. Sorry for maybe a too long answer, but thank you so much for your questions. We move on to the next one. Nako.
Wonderful, wonderful. Thank you so much, Johan. Nako speaking. What I would like to just stress, I don't know whether it came across systematically. You said survival, wellness, freedom, and identity, and the negations of these four are?
Death. Illness. Repression. And alienation.
Okay, Nako speaking, that was just to make sure that the systematicity is complete, because we actually do work with this on every single case, including, thank you, Perry Husbands, ecological questions of needs. The next person in line is Natalie with a brilliant technical question and perhaps another one. Natalie?
Hello, everyone. Natalie speaking. Nako, I had two questions. Which one do you refer?
The one that I just saw was whether there is, Johan, an overlap between the diagnosis, prognosis, therapy, and the equity, harmony, conflict, trauma approach. I personally have never asked myself that question so far.
Natalie again. Thank you, Nako. So, Professor, I was raising that question because you had this formula of peace perspective, which in every case you narrate that very clearly in using the DPT approach. And then recently one of our material also looked at another very systematic approach, which is the peace formula. So I was just wondering if they overlap, because to me, they certainly do, but I'm not sure whether I should make a distinction within their overlapping. Over to you, Professor.
So it's a question of comparing the DPT to, I didn't get the second one.
To the peace formula, and Natalie did something that we haven't done, which is, she reduced the equity, harmony, conflict, and trauma elements of the numerator and denominator to EHCT. And she asked, does DPT and EHCT overlap? Over from me.
No. These are simply two different ways of looking at things. So there is absolutely no overlap between them. DPT, diagnosis, prognosis, therapy, is a way of working in general terms. You can say analysis, forecasting, remedies. And I point out very often that when you come to the remedies, you will find out that you have to change your analysis. So it's not a linear system. But it is a working agenda for you. The formula, equity, and today I actually don't say harmony, I say empathy. And you'll find that changes in many of the papers. Empathy is a little bit deeper than harmony. It's the way to get to harmony. You see, very many people have said that peace is cooperation and harmony. And I say, fine. But cooperation has to be equitable. And the harmony has to be based on empathy. Now, equity, empathy, and then in the denominator, under the fraction line, you have, of course, 12 mind conflicts. And then they can loom very large and reduce peace to nothing. That formula, naturally, has T written on it for Sera. It is not DNP, it is T for Sera. You can say that you start with trying to analyze the situation. And my advice is try to find the underlying conflict or trouble. If you encounter violence, underlying conflict and trauma. Then you move on to prognosis. And here I have indicated that in general, there are four types of prognosis. And that comes from medical science and it comes from peace science. But let me say health science rather than medical, because medical points to medicine. And the moment you call it medical science, you're making propaganda for all the pharmacies in the world and the pharmaceutical industry. Let us call it health science. So the four prognoses are the following. Point one, it will take care of itself. In other words, the system has resilience and immunity capacity. You have the white blood corpuscles fighting intruders. You have common sense taking care of the violence by identifying something that can be remedied, and so on. Diagnosis number two. There will be violence, but it is at a low level, and you can live with it. You have a family. Sometimes there is shouting, sometimes the children fight, but it's not excessive, you can live with it. There is no blood running, there is no excessive shouting, you can live with it. Prognosis number three, it's going to get worse. And then we jump to prognosis number four. It's going to get worse. Much worse. In health science, death is inevitable. Then in peace science, what is it that is dying? It's not the persons, but the relationship between them. Let us say that we are dealing with a couple, a marriage on the rocks, as they say. What might be dying? It's the marriage, not the people, not the two. I'm so old-fashioned that I usually talk about husband and wife. So, if you put it that way, you have four prognoses. It's the third prognosis that is the interesting one. It's going to get worse. And then you split the prognosis in two. Without therapy and with therapy. And you can see a sort of curve of wellness going down. You're in the illness sector, and it's going down and down. And the question is how to turn it around and turn it upwards. That's called therapy. So from this point, as my colleague Erika de Cortes on this point out, Johan has two prognoses. One is without therapy and one is with therapy. And the therapy, Natalie? I have tried to boil down to the four factors in the formula. I have longer lists, and we'll come to that. But this is just a kind of simple beginning. And I am saying that if you start where I said you should start with the analysis, doing some reconciliation work and doing some solution work, and if on top of that, you try to build some equitable relations between the partners, and you try to increase their empathy with themselves and with the other partners, not the least with themselves. If you do that, you're on a good road. You can get it in writing from me that this is, I think you are on a good road, it's time to hang up. So, these two lists, one with three elements, one with four elements, do in no way overlap. But the one with four elements is the spelling out of the last part of the three elements, the T in the DPT. Is that clear, Natalia? Hello, Natalie.
Hello, Natalie.
Hello, can you hear me? Yes, thank you, Professor. It's clear.
You are so welcome. So welcome. Thank you. I don't see you, unfortunately. I just see a silhouette. But
It's on purpose because it's on pajama mode. I'll try to do better next time.
In the pajama mode. But that will be even more interesting.
Oh, thank you. Over and out. Oh, Nako, sorry, still Natalie. If I have time to ask one more question, which I have sent earlier today, after everyone gets their turn to go around.
Go right ahead. No interruption, just straight to the question.
Oh, okay. Actually, I had another question. And, well, the context is actually raising awareness and popularity. Perhaps not everyone would agree with the term popularity, so I would just stick with raising awareness of this field, which is peace research and peace study. That's the context. And then I sent three diagrams today to NACO with all the circles and all that. And I was thinking, well, the more I read and the more I listen, watch your videos, it seems like, oh, any solutions, however naive, or I'm not yet sophisticated, so I wouldn't say that, but however far I feel like, oh, I thought of these solutions, and then I come across your article and say, that's been thought of like ages ago, Natalie. Not only it has been thought of when I looked at the year that the article was published, and it's like, that's been thought of long ago, Natalie. It's not even remotely original. So I you thought understand. Like, what's wrong?
This is a talk given.
Eh?
Could you come to the question?
Yes. So my question is...
Welcome.
Well, there is all these circles. I was thinking, why at the moment, the way I see our field of study is, we're only interacting to a limited degree with other social actors. What I mean by social actors in this case is like government agencies, non-government agencies, academic organizations or agencies. So I was thinking, why can't we enlarge our influence in those social actors organizations? That's number one. And number two, maybe we can even transform even bigger or better in the future, not only influencing their way of thinking to resort more to peaceful conflict transformations, but actually making peaceful conflict transformations as a way of life. So that's the context of all my circle. Okay. But the subtext to this is really, why aren't we more popular out there?
Be aware of that you are not the only participant here. There are many, many who are going to talk, and we have limited time. Sorry for reproaching you on that one, because here you see there is a goal. Naku and I have a goal, and that is to be attentive to all of you. So, let us now be very clear what it is about. I'm not going to comment on other approaches. The course we are having here is essentially the transcend approach. Of course, governments and agencies are very important actors. How do we go about it? we have to identify their goals and we have to identify our own goals. So let us say that the government has at its goal, as a very basic goal, to have the final word. Maybe we also, some of us, NGOs, also have as a goal to have the final word. So how do you reconcile those two goals? Through dialogue. In other words, not debate, which is for one to win and have the final word, but the dialogue, which is an ongoing process. In other words, we try to introduce into the culture of the country.
We're not going
to
be done by 11, I don't think.
It's important to understand the difference between dialogue and debate. Let me at this point just remind you of the three basic steps in the transcend approach to solving conflict. You go by small numbers, 2, 3, 4, the three basic steps. Now, I can say it and you can write it down. The only way to understand it is to practice it. Point one, mapping the conflict. Who are the parties? What do they want? What are their goals? Where do the goals clash? That's not it. Do we get at it? Who is the one who said that very clear? Sigmund Freud.
Sorry, Johan. Nako speaking. Sorry, Johan. I have to interrupt briefly to ask someone to turn off their microphone because we hear more of the typing than of your voice. And I'm out for now.
Hello, guys. You asked me to go ahead with my question. I just put it down there very, very...
Hold on a second. Sorry, I interrupted the professor because we heard some typing. So I ask all of you to turn off the microphone.
If one of the parties to a conflict is not prepared or is unwilling to put forward goals which are not already viewed as the other...
Okay, Narco, you tell me when I shall continue.
Okay, we're having a little bit of a technical problem. Liam's question is next, and I think after Liam is Neve's question, because they're dropping out for various reasons. But we're having some technical issues with Liam's question, and Neve's question is next. Sorry for interrupting you, Johan.
I would prefer you to read the questions.
All right, I will do.
I was a little bit shocked by all the talk and the inability to come quickly to the question.
Nako speaking. Thanks for pointing it out, Johan. Let us please all get succinctly to the clear and concise question so everyone can speak. Liam, if you're hearing this, please type your question so that I can read it to the professor. And Neve, I know that you're leaving now. Johan, sorry for interrupting you. If you could finish your answer, and then Niam and Liv's question come in.
I just reminded you of the three stages we go through when we try to solve the conflict. Point one, mapping. And I pointed out that that means finding out who are the parties, what do they want, where are the clashes. Point two, legitimacy. And here you enter with law, human rights, and basic needs. I talked much about that in response to the first set of questions. And number three, bridging, transcendence, finding a new reality where conflicting goals, incompatible goals, can be accommodated. And that demands creativity. The difficulty in this whole approach is creativity. What I find in other approaches, to be quite blunt about it, is the absence of creativity. It is not creativity just to say that they should sit down and talk together. That's not creativity. That's a method to arrive at creativity. It may also not be a method. Maybe they shouldn't sit down. Maybe they should separately think, go deeply into themselves, maybe the road to mediation is through meditation, which would be the Buddhist approach. But the creativity, imaging a new reality, is the basic point of the transcendent approach. We'll come back to that. Nako, your turn.
Thank you very much. Neve, you're next in line as Liam is not responding right now.
Hello, Neve speaking here.
Go ahead.
So,
another question.
No problem. My question is in your reading on professionalization, you talked about the challenge for peace practitioners in dealing with conflicts such as genocide and mass hunger, where there doesn't seem to be clear kind of parties to deal with. Can you elaborate on how you think that these can be dealt with and whether they are actually suitable contexts for peace practitioners in the first place?
Nako, could you repeat that?
That was so fast. Neve, please come again, Neve.
Oh, I'm sorry. My accent is quite strong. I'll have to slow down. Sorry.
I thought you were in writing, Nako.
Oh, yes, I have them in writing too. I just wanted to...
Why don't you read it?
Hang on, Nako, I will send it to you now, just so it's easier for you.
Johan, there's a number of questions that I have here. That's the problem. And,
okay. Sorry, Nako, I just sent you the first one there.
Take one at a time, please.
All right, so here it is. In your reading on professionalization, Johan, you talk about the challenge for peace practitioners in dealing with conflicts such as genocide and mass hunger. Can you elaborate on how you think these can be dealt with or whether they are suitable contexts for peace practitioners to start with in the first place?
Well, look, I cannot go into all of that, but let me start with mass hunger. You see, be quite sure that you understand what a conflict is. It's not the same as a problem. You could have mass hunger because there simply is no food. That's not a conflict. The conflict is when somebody wants you to die. Of mass hunger. The most famous case is, of course, the English colonization of India and the mass hunger in Bengal and Churchill wanting them to die in order not to have to feed them. They have a conflict. The solution to that conflict, which was very, very famous, was decolonization. And as Amartya Sen is pointing out so many times, very wisely, that one road to development is via freedom. Freedom in the sense of independence. You are master in your own house. It's unbelievable that the West still goes on, although he's probably coming to his end now, as I come, saluting Churchill as the big statesman. He was a racist, fundamental racist. I can also pick up the point that he wanted an end to Gandhi by having him chained outside the gate of New Delhi and the viceroy sitting on an elephant trampling Gandhi to death. Just to give a little image of what kind of guy that was. Now, having said that, I think Churchill's goal was illegitimate. And when you have one party having a legitimate goal, namely food, to be fed, to feed oneself. And the other party has an illegitimate goal, a totally illegitimate goal, namely your death. Then you are in a situation where it's not a question of mediation and finding an in-between position. Will you please be so kind, let only half of them starve to death. It's a question of fighting. Is fighting, according to the transcend way of thinking, is nonviolent. Now that nonviolence, Gandhi, who knew all of this about the Bengali hunger and everything, was the Gandhian approach in the case of India. So I just mentioned it. I took up mass hunger. That's one point. As we know today, the world has more than enough capacity to produce the food for 7 billion people, or 7.5 billion. 45 billion, no problem either, according to some specialists in the field. It's not the problem. The problem is the distribution. And the problem are the structural fences that are put up and the lack of a solidarity culture with everybody. It is coming. There is more of it than it used to be. Even in my short lifetime, only 85 years, but it's given this kind of historical perspective. Okay? You can see something coming. I think we let that do for that question. Nako, will you please move on?
Wonderful. Nako speaking. The next question is also twofold, but I think important. One is justice. How does your approach, it's not clear how the Transcend approach either defines justice or is different from the justice approach to peace, number one. And number two, how does the Transcend approach make sure that the mediator does not become too powerful or a conflict party him or herself? Over.
The first question rests on a very dubious assumption that people know what justice is. In my long cohabitation on earth with that word, there are at least four interpretations of the word justice, and they are completely different. The first division is between criminal justice and social justice. Criminal justice, to very many, simply means punishment. It means that justice has been served. Justice has been served. Justice est faite in French, when the guillotine has cut off a head. That is violence. I cannot live with that concept as a part of a peace package. The second one is better, and that is restorative justice. Restore the, let's call it criminal, the one who has broken the law. Restore. Well, depends on how you go about it. The by far best method that I know is the ho'oponopono of the Polynesian culture, which was then simplified brutally, intellectually, down to almost nothing, but gave the criminal a chance to speak his mind and sit in a circle. The point is that the ho'oponopono is so much more subtle than anything that came to the West. And the basic point in the ho'oponopono is equal attention to acts of commission, the criminal act, and acts of omission, all those who did nothing to prevent it. And that has not survived that intellectual brutal crime done to the indigenous Polynesian culture called restorative justice. I can say more about that. Now. This is equality of opportunity. Sounds good. But the problem is that you can have equality of opportunity and still end up with an extremely unequal, unjust society. And much work has been done to create equality of opportunity through the schooling system. More or less perfect, because you have schools that are for everybody and schools that prepare the coming elite from day one. But the basic point is not that. So the basic point is that even with the equality of opportunity, you can end up with enormous inequality of life called structural violence. Now, the fourth interpretation of justice is, I would say, equity. is that you organize interaction in such a way that equality comes out of it. And this is the enormous contribution of the feminist revolution, the word parity, that the negation of patriarchy, with the man exercising not only structural violence, but also direct violence, the negation of that is not matriarchy, the negation is parity. Parity, and I would then say that is based on equitable cooperation, and feminists have shown the way, sharing the good parts of life and sharing the menial and not so interesting parts of life. Let's call them the dirty, boring parts of life. You could try to minimize them, maybe even through robotization, but sharing. But empathy, for men to understand women and for women to understand men, I think it is something that has to enter our education. And I think we are still very short of that. You can see the West trying to come to grips with Islam and doing very badly. Whereas Islam has no difficulty understanding the West, because of the 57 Islamic countries, 56 were colonized by us. And the 57 is Iran, which is one reason why the West has always been skeptical about Iran. It's too independent. Well, empathy. We try to come to grip with Islam, and Islam is an Occidental religion. It came out, it's Abrahamic, came out of the Judaism Christianity legacy as number three, and there may be more coming. Now, the point that I'm arriving at now is that all that Western culture has never been able to come to grips with Hinduism, Buddhism, Taoism, Shintoism, and I could take the Polynesian civilization as another example. Indigenous civilizations, we often say. We have left that to cultural anthropologists, but they have a tendency to be very local and go for a small community, their own private community, and don't touch my community. In other words, they're poorly equipped when it comes to empathy. So, I have said that to try to give some life to those concepts. Does this constitute some answer?
That, I think, is very well. The next points are two. I repeat the last one from my last intervention, Nako speaking. Point one, how do we avoid the mediator becoming a conflict party, him or herself? And this is linked with the next point. I think they're very linked. How does the transcendent mediator... Pardon me?
You see, it becomes too much.
Okay.
I think it's a very basic question. How do we prevent the mediator from becoming too powerful? I am absolutely, totally in agreement with the question. It hits straight to me. My problem is not that I have too little power or anything of the kind. My problem is that I have too much. I'm very deeply aware of it, and my answer to it, by spreading, by sharing the knowledge about how to handle violence, so that it becomes a part of a general culture. In the book, The Art of Peace, and in other books, you will find 9 approaches or something like that to this basic problem. The peace culture, conflict resolution culture, trauma conciliation culture, the basic one. And of course, the parallel is with hygiene. Hygiene, washing hands, brushing teeth, and so on. In other words, sharing. It becomes a general knowledge for people how to handle a conflict. And if I should just take the brushing teeth, washing hands, part of it, Find out what your own goals are. Find out the goals of the other party. Search for something that could be done so that the goals can both be satisfied. Complete hygiene. But the question is excellent, and hits me directly in my soul. But I'm very aware of it.
The next question has to do with power between the parties you are mediating with. If there is a power imbalance between the parties you are a mediator on, and the imbalance is given, it's a given, how do you work on that, since one may simply not feel the need to adjust to reciprocity with the other party? The power imbalance is a given.
Very well formulated, and here's the answer. By pushing that logic aside in favor of an other logic, and that other logic can only come if you have had dialogue with the parties, found out what their visions of the future is, and you're being creative enough to come up with a vision that embraces them. A compelling vision. Where the vision simply gives so much to both parties and so much in addition to that. They get an extra. As my Japanese wife says, it is goal number one plus goal number two plus an alpha. Something extra. The compelling vision. And they look at it, and my experience is that sooner or later they are saying, that was not exactly what I wanted. I actually wanted to beat him. He deserves to be a good rapping over his fingers. And in addition to that, I would like to take the cake and eat it too. And here they are talking about sharing the cake, and not only that, but an expanding cake. Okay, I can live with that, but I'm quite sure that other guy will not accept it. I cannot count the number of times I've heard that. And the other guy has said exactly the same. I can live with that compelling vision, quote unquote, but I'm sure the other one cannot. It's a question of changing logic. It's a question of leaving the power scheme of thinking. How can I make you do what I want you to do? Leaving that logic behind in favor of a logic, how can you and I together establish something new that will not only give us what we want, but also give us more? Evidently, creativity is needed for that. And my standard pedagogical example is Ecuador and Peru, struggling, fighting for 500 square kilometers up in the Andes. And my proposal to run it together, not to draw a border, but run it together as a two-state zone. And I then suggested making it even more beautiful for those of you by having a natural park. They did that. And the violence stopped. Terrible warfare. One of the two biggest wars in Latin American history. Terrible warfare. That had gone on from 1941. Originally stimulated by two U.S. oil companies. Now, what then happened was that they did better than what I had proposed. They actually, in addition to a natural park, made a joint economic zone, where you did not only have interaction between the two capitals, between Quito in Ecuador and Lima in Peru, but between the peasants. Let us say farmers, the poor farmers, on both sides, exchanging products, meeting in that zone, and expanding it then to become bigger and bigger. In short, peace. A little bit of creativity was needed, and the reaction of the ex-president of Ecuador when I presented it, I'll never forget. Very creative, Professor Galton, but too creative. Okay? Too creative for him, but 3 years later, the deal was signed.
Thank you very much, Johan. Can I ask you, because I know that you've given us a bit more than the time you usually allocate for these, for 30 more minutes.
Oh, yeah, surely. That will be no problem. Just go ahead, but we just have to be quick. I mean, of course, I'm the one who does most of the talking. Just go straight to the questions, one at a time, please.
Okay, this is Liam's question. Unfortunately, he's not here anymore, but it's good to put it. So you speak of mapping, legitimizing, and bridging, Professor Gautam. The question is, what if you're dealing with parties that are in such discord that they consider the other party's goals illegitimate to start with, from the beginning?
Well, that's a very good question. First of all, and the basic approach to this is to find out whether they have understood the other party's goal. They usually haven't. It's my experience that Washington understands almost nobody's goal. Because if they feel that somebody is anti-American, anti-US, then they're not listening to anything. I'll take one example immediately, just to make it clear. When you talk with the Taliban, you find out that most of them are Pashtuns. And you ask them, what is your goal? And they say, do away with the Durand line, the totally artificial border between Pakistan and Afghanistan. That drove a wedge through the Pashtun nation. And most Pashtuns are Taliban, and most Taliban are Pashtun. You see, that line, the Durand line, I never hear US politicians talk about it. On the contrary, what they do is now to build a fence, imitating the fence, the Israeli fence, and their own fence against the Mexicans, making the situation even worse. And this is splitting the biggest nation today, about 50 million people, the Pashtun, into parts. And they're not permitted to travel, to move into what to them is their own territory. That doesn't mean that they want a Pashtunistan. They want open borders. They want, in other words, Afghanistan and Pakistan joining together, maybe in some kind of Central Asian community. That's where the solution is located. So, from a Washington point of view, since the Taliban are fighting, are violent, it looks totally illegitimate. Now, how about the US? Well, the US has one very basic goal, which I think is totally legitimate. I think they go about it the wrong way, but I think the goal is totally legitimate, not to be attacked. No Pearl Harbor, no 9/11. Not to be attacked. Now, the way to go about it is, of course, to find out who is it who could possibly want to attack us. Why do they want to do that? What's the underlying conflict? What's the underlying trauma? What can we do about it? It's not the US way to go about it. The US way to go about it is to kill them. And in doing that, producing even more hatred and likelihood that the violent act against the United States may happen. That's the tragedy, but I emphasize again, I have identified what to my mind is a very legitimate goal in the US.
Thank you, Johan. Next question is about isomorphism. And the question is, Luke, perhaps you want to ask the question in as concise a manner as you need it to be. Over, Nako.
Luke speaking. Professor, just 1 second. Isomorphism appears to be an enhancing tool in the peace workers' toolbox that is then used to nurture positive relationships through the dialogue. I think taking this mathematical concept and applying it to peace is very interesting. Is isomorphism applicable throughout all levels of conflict, through intra and interpersonal, intra, interregional, and so forth?
Thank you for the question. Yes, I would say it is not only applicable to all the four levels of conflict. You know, mega, the big level between civilizations and regions. Macro, between nations and states. Meso, inside states, across Falklands. Class, race, gender, generation. And micro, the individual level, between individuals and inside individuals. The concept is not only applicable for all of the four levels, but between them. That's the interesting thing. So I can sit mediating between Ecuador and Peru. I just mentioned the example. I find Peru extremely domineering, Ecuador tenacious, holding on, not wanting to lose anything more. And I can, the same day or the next day, the next month, be mediating a marriage. But it strikes me that in this case, the wife behaves exactly like Peru. And the husband, like Ecuador. So I have an isomorphism going on in my mind. Nehru then calls to ask the question, what did I propose in connection with Ecuador Peru, and can I propose something similar there? Well, I proposed a two-state zone and some activity in it. So a two-state zone and with activity means cooperation. Owning it together. And this is a marriage on the rocks. What could they own together? I often use the example. I have a marriage consisting of a business husband and a very devoted Buddhist wife. Both of them wanting to convert the other. He wants her out of the Buddhism back to being a regular wife in a bourgeois, consumer-oriented society. She wants him to embrace Buddhism. He's much less concerned with business and much with the inner wealth, that is it. So I designed a project for them, namely to run together a bookstore business for Buddhist books, Buddhism. In other words, I took both of them seriously and at their best. He as a talented businessman, she as a devoted Buddhist. And all I can say is this happened about 20 years ago and the bookstore still exists. Why? I'm not saying that the Buddhist bookstore is a new reality, but it was a new reality for them, and that's what matters. In other words, I have tried to indicate how I can be inspired by one conflict and bring some ideas into another one. And the bridging question that I ask myself is, what does this remind me of? What does this remind me of? And the first time I came to Afghanistan and asked myself that question, the answer was Switzerland. In other words, as an isomorphism between the Afghan configuration and the Swiss configuration. and I've been drawing on them to come up with proposals. So, don't call it a mathematical concept. It's true, it is used in mathematics, but it is much broader. Be aware that morpha stands for structure, and iso stands for the same, like an isobar, same structure. In other words, this corresponds to that, and that corresponds to this. What can I learn from? Thanks for the question.
Thank you very much. The next question is about language and culture. And the question is, has your introduction of medical language, medical metaphors, medical ethics, medical methodology into peace studies, does it serve the purpose of introducing a language that allows us as peace workers to overcome the limitations that may be inbuilt into languages such as English, Japanese, German, or whatever language that may be?
Very, very good point. Yes, exactly. Precisely. Not to be limited by these languages. Let me take an example immediately. We talk about diseases in plural, because there are several types of diseases. But the English language does not permit violences. We should. And I use it quite often. I simply break the rule in English and learn. Because if you only talk about violence, you make it too simple, too unique, too sort of essentialist, instead of having a typology. And health science went very much further by recognizing that there are diseases and diseases and diseases and diseases. However, they still talk about health and not health in plural. I think they would do well by using the word health, learning from their own use of plural in diseases. Because you have negative health, the absence of diseases, not only the absence of their symptoms, and you have positive health, building a resilient body and mind and spirit that can withstand exposure to pathogenic factors, the factors that bring pathology, diseases with them. Now, I bring that into peace studies, and I talk about pieces. You see, if you use only the word peace, it becomes so essentialist and doesn't carry distinct meanings. Like, for instance, the distinction between negative and positive peace. So I try, starting with the word diseases in plural, to be inspired to overcome basic problem in the English language. I can give you another example. I have no difficulty when I talk about structures in using the word hierarchy. A pyramid, very vertical. Nor do I have difficulty with the polyarchy, because it means that there are several structures at the same time. Could be something vertical and something horizontal. A very good example being the Indian system. Caste, horribly vertical. The community, as they call it. The intra-caste, being very horizontal, cordial and friendly. An Indian traveling from one end of the country to the other might look for a hotel in his own community. Now, this is less known because we stereotype India by looking only at caste. It's a polyarchy. Nor do I have difficulty in English with anarchy. That means it is neither horizontal nor vertical. It is just simply each individual for himself, postmodernity has often been seen that way. But then comes the interesting thing. Imagine you have a structure which is only horizontal. What do you call it? There is no word in English that expresses it. You have hierarchy, polyarchy, anarchy. So I introduced equiarchy. It doesn't exist in English. Let me make a guess. It will enter Oxford Dictionary because there's an evident need for something to express. The horizontality of people sitting in a circle around the table, everybody being related to everybody, nobody being in charge of anybody. There may be somebody organizing the flow of communication, but not imposing anything. There is a need for a word for that. Interestingly, that word doesn't exist in English. English has a built-in verticality. Now, the anarchy exists even in a one-letter word capitalized for the ego, the I in English. It's no other language in the world projects egocentrism. Egoism up so high. So not strange that Adam Smith came out of that culture. Well, having said that, I can only congratulate you on the wisdom of your question, and I hope my examples conveyed something.
And there's two more that I really love to bring to you. One is from Carol, who couldn't be here today, and her question is, your approach, DPT, seems to be very good at the overall picture, at the mega level with an overview. But what is the expert or the specialist to do who has to study the details of an issue, of a case that she or he is studying at hand? How do you get into the details and not the general overview that DPT seems to advocate? She asked this after reading 5100.
I think I have it. There's a basic misunderstanding here, a very basic one. The DPT applies to all four levels. And it is used by psychoanalysts and psychiatrists very much at the micro level. I could say that I think they should learn a couple of things from Transcend, and they are picking up a couple of things, namely positive mental health as opposed to only mental disorder. And that concept, of course, is basic to the whole Transcend approach. But in no way is the DPT approach better at the mega level or more adjusted to the mega level. First of all, the mega level is much more difficult. Much more difficult. Aware of the fact that at the mega level, between civilizations, between regions, you also have countries, states, and nations. You also have the fault lines inside societies. And you also sometimes have to count on quite problematic personalities. In other words, you cannot do the mega level without the macro and the meso and the micro. And I am arguing that you cannot do macro without having mega in your mind. You have to look at the big, big conflicts in the world if you want to do something with conflicts between two countries, for instance. So to add just a line to that, I suggested Ecuador and Peru cooperate. Are you aware of the fact? Are you aware of the fact that in January, 33 countries in Latin America and the Caribbean met in Quito, the fourth summit meeting? There is today simply a Latin American Caribbean reality the heads of state from 33 countries, the fourth summit they already had, and almost not a word in the Western press, and particularly not the US press, since this is exactly what they hate most. They are used to manipulate them bilaterally, US with each one singly, not combined. And suddenly they stand up there against the resolution recommending compensation for slave trade and slavery as the most atrocious crimes, or among the most atrocious crimes in humanity. It's another way of talking from what they are used to up in the US. So I just mention it as an example. Now, this is important. Very, very important. And I repeat, the concept applies to mega, macro, meso, and micro. And very often you have to apply to all of them together. Okay, now.
Thank you very much, which leads us to the next question, which is, when you're dealing with cultures, different cultures, how do you have a system, a method, key points of how you read a culture when you meet one? How do you read cultures when you meet them? How do you differentiate cultures when you see them?
It's a very good way of formulating. Yes, I do. And it is in the chart that I think Marco may have communicated, or may not, but Marco, you can easily send it to them. It is, of course, the big chart, where you have six cultures horizontally, and seven ways of asking the culture, what do you stand for? You remember that chart number. Marco?
Yes, I do, and I'll provide them with it.
Wonderful, do that. Now, I have seven questions that I ask of the culture. So this time I have a slightly higher number than you heard the seven. I only hope that I remember it correctly myself. Where do you stand on nature? And of course, basic possible answers are partnership, or we are above nature. Second one. Where do you stand on the individual? And here I use, as a point of departure, a kind of Freudian approach. You see the individual as dominated by nature, or the individual as dominated by the context culture, or the individual more as an individual, as different from all others. So Western culture is more individualist, Buddhist culture is more collectivist in the sense of there being a common culture dominating all of them, if you will. Next, how do you look at society, the social construction? Do you see it as static or dynamic? Do you see dynamism in the sense that people can move up and maybe also down the social ladder? Do you see it as vertical or horizontal? Now, I ask the question and I ask them to come up with their answers. I do not impose answers on them. So I'm only giving these answers as examples. Then I go to world society. So I now have nature, person, society, world is number four coming up. The world society, how do you look at the world? And again, I could say vertical, horizontal. You see it as essentially a security problem or a cooperation problem, and so on. From then I go to time. Time as a basic factor, that becomes number five. Now just mention number six and seven so that we have it. 6 is the transcendental, and 7 is epistemology. So I came to 5 time. And the kind of things that I am looking for would be whether they see time as sort of constant, just a line, which was very important in the Middle Ages, no change. Or do you see it as oscillating up and down? Or do you see it as progress, going up and up and up? In other words, how do you see time? I could make a distinction between time A and time B. Time A for individuals, time B for societies. And we go on to the next one. As I mentioned, number 6 is the transcendental. Is there something beyond us? Christians would say God. Muslims would say Allah. Represented on earth by one person, the Prophet. The Christians would say God represented on earth by one person, Jesus Christ, the offspring of God through the intermediation of the Holy Spirit and Virgin Mary. Now, there are different answers, and all these answers are important. And we then come after the transcendental to epistemology. It's a kind of umbrella concept. How do you know that your answers to these questions are right or wrong? What is your basic criterion of truth? What is true? Well, I would then be looking for answers like empiricism. You check with the data. I would be interested in answers relating truth to value. That which is correct is true. And that is, of course, very important in contemporary language about correct politics. The politics of correctness. Whoever defines what is correct. So I have 7 very precise questions, and I have a feeling that when I have the answers to those questions, I can say, hello, culture. I know something. I think I know, and I think I can ask you more questions, because I think I have the framework within which you are operating. So that's my answer. And cultural anthropologists are the people who have most experience with this. They're very particular. Thank you.
Thank you very, very much. I have still a number of questions under my belt, but in fact, if I'm not mistaken, and if I am, please come in, whoever it is, I think I've asked from every participant at least one question. And if I've let out anyone, please come in and say so now. Okay.
You're able to formulate the question.
Okay. So now, Johan, I still have a couple of questions, but we have covered at least one question per participant thus far. Should I present the remaining as well?
Yeah, go ahead, Michael.
Wonderful. So the next question that I have is Abrahamic West and Islam. I'm reading off the wrong list. 3, 2, 1 question. When engaged in dialogues that have broken down for whatever reason, how has this experience helped to inform future strategies of implementing diagnosis, prognosis, therapy? And what are some of the most challenging lessons that you have experienced going through such a process?
So let us say that we are dealing with a macro-level conflict and the dialogue with the foreign minister breaks down. Usually you only have a dialogue with the foreign minister. What about somebody lower down in the hierarchy? in the prime ministry. You find somebody else for a dialogue. And maybe the responses and the outcomes of the dialogue will float upwards. So the answer, no, don't take no for an answer. Go to somebody else and find a yes. I think I would leave it at that because we need concrete cases to know what to do. But I have given you my general answer. Find somebody else.
Excellent. And here is an element to that question. How do you evaluate in general, methodologically, a post-mediation situation? Are there any metrics that are not applicable to human behavior? What types of data can you draw on from successful mediation?
Well, be aware now that we are operating with a couple of criteria. One is a decrease, maybe even reduction to zero of violence. That's one way of evaluating, but be aware now that we are talking not only of direct violence, but also of structural violence. The worst thing that can happen is that you buy absence of direct violence at the expense of structural violence. The European Union did exactly that. You have had absence of direct violence, no threat of war, and enormous structural violence building up between, you can say, Germany and the rest. You can say the north of European Union and the south, and it is about money, but also about power in general. So that is the first criteria, is the reduction to absence of violence. And there is a second criteria, and a third. To what extent did they get their original goals satisfied? Take the Ecuador-Peru example. Ecuador may say, Peru may say, okay, we now have access to the whole zone. But I wanted to have access alone. It should be my zone, a part of my land. Have they been able to overcome that limitation and see their goal nevertheless as satisfied, even if the goal has been changed a little bit? And the third question is, do they feel that they have benefited from something extra? Well, in the case of Ecuador Peru, they are benefiting from increased trade between the two countries. Via the zones in the middle, the two-state zones that have become economic zones, joint economic zones. In the case of the marriage, I used as an example, they're running a bookstore together. They're making money. In addition to that, very important for her particularly, but increasingly for him, they see Buddhism spreading through the books they are selling. Important. So here you have three levels of testing whether you actually have obtained what you wanted. Very important things and very important question. And this is where Western empiricism, Western empirical methods come in. True. I have said that they are not alone good enough. You need Western criticism. And you need also, coming from the West actually, Giambattista Vico's creativism. And you need certainly the Taoist, the Yin Yang perspective. Thank you. Next question, Michael?
Absolutely. This is Patrice's question. Do you think that national borders in general are useful? What do you think about national borders? Do you think the world in general needs to move into a region, into regionalization? And if you think so, what exactly do you mean by that?
I think we should keep in mind that there are people who like to be together and there are people who don't like to be together. And that goes by nature. Oh, there is very choice, so I don't know whether I can continue talking.
Sorry, Johan. Someone's microphone is on and will be turned off shortly after hearing this. Sorry.
Okay.
Please come again, Johan.
Okay. So some people like to be together and some people don't like to be together. I think it's important to have borders, but they should be open. They should be open, but it should be some kind of demarcation. And it's very easy to use Switzerland as an example. But to say there are four Switzerlands, German-speaking, French-speaking, Italian-speaking, Ladino, or Retoromanisch is what I call it, speaking. And the borders are relatively clear. Relatively clear. And they're meaningful, but they're open. They're all open. In other words, it is possible for any Swiss to live in a place where the people around him talk the same language and he feels at home. When he crosses a certain border, he feels less at home. So those borders would be between nations. And I repeat, they are legitimate. Now, we have the state borders. And if we say that we have about 2,000 nations in the world and 200 states, we have an average of 10 nations inside each state. And these state borders are highly problematic. First of all, they put together inside sometimes people who don't like each other. Well, that opens for federations inside. In other words, borders between the nations, but open borders. Then those states keep apart people who would like to be together because they're very similar. Okay? That is what calls for communities and confederations, again with open borders. Of course, the German-speaking Swiss want to be able to relate to Frankfurt and Berlin. The border is open. The French-speaking to Paris. The border is open. The Italian-speaking to Milano, Roma. The border is open. And then you have the Retoromanish people who want to relate to other Swiss, to the whole world for that matter. The border is open. And I could then take all of that and by the logic of isomorphism project it onto Afghanistan, where you have not four nations, but at least eight. One of them, the Hazara, only in Afghanistan. The other seven also outside. Where does it lead us? An Afghan federation, maybe with eight parts. And at the same time, a Central Asian community with open borders to those that speak languages also spoken in Afghanistan. And that would mean to the Kazakhs, Kyrgyz, Tajik, Uzbeks, Turkmens, the five stans in the old Soviet Union, it would mean to Iran, where they of course speak Persian, called Dari inside Afghanistan. It would mean to Pakistan, as I have mentioned, where they speak Urdu. Let us say an Arabized form of Hindi. And it would mean Azad Kashmir, the part of Kashmir that is the Pakhtun part of Pakistan. So you take those two principles and you simply project them onto reality and you come up with something very close to a vision of what might be a compelling vision. Thank you for that.
Thank you,
Johan. Very important.
Yep, sorry. Sorry for interrupting, Johan. Could you finish?
No, not at all. I'm just waiting for the next question, Michael.
We're finally getting to the end a little bit. The next one is this.
We have 5 minutes left.
5 minutes, okay. So your frames of reference and use of metaphor appear strategic in your writings. Now, you use the terms synchronic and diachronic in ways of defining relationships and conflict through time. How do you influence synchronic and diachronic relationships simultaneously when you're in a dialogue trying to get solutions out?
Well, that's the last question, and it's a fantastic question. And this is where the histomap enters. And you may or may not have shown it, but you could show something of it. You take an actor through time. Take the Roman Empire. A little tiny birth in minus 750. And you see it expand and expand and expand and expand, and then starting contracting. And in year 476, in year 395, it splits into two, the Western Empire and the Eastern Roman Empire. The Eastern Roman Empire with the capital in Constantinople. And the Western Empire collapses down to zero in 476. The Eastern lasts an incredible 1,000 years longer and collapses in 1453 when Constantinople becomes Istanbul and a part of the later on Ottoman Osmanic Empire. In other words, you see something through time. And in the histomap, the synchronic relation, you take a year or a period and you read off the world as it is at that time. The diachronic, you follow an actor through time, maybe being born, expanding, contracting, dying, or maybe keeping more or less going in the same place all the time, China. Very different Chinas, as different as Europe, but in the same place by and large. Expansion and battles inside that one, bloody transfers from one dynasty to the other, but all of it inside what the Chinese call the Chinese pocket between the Himalayas, the Gobi Desert, the tundra, and the sea, including much of the sea in Tibet. As we know. In other words, you can say that if you want to look at China, it is more diachronic and less synchronic. The diachronic becomes important. You want to look at the West, the synchrony and diachrony, both of them, of course. Both apply to both. But the synchrony, the relation to other parts of the world, and particularly the parts they have conquered, where they get into trouble, so that the Western Empire sooner or later collapse, like the U.S. Empire is now collapsing. I mentioned a little bit earlier in this session the incredible meeting of 33 Latin American and Caribbean states in Quito. Heads of state, the fourth summit. A new actor has been born. It has been born and it is operating. And since it is not exactly to the U.S. liking, not reported in the Western media. Okay, this I think is what I had to say. I just want to thank you for all your excellent questions, absolutely excellent. And we go ahead with the course, and you have your first assignment, which is a tough one, and it is expected to be a collective response. Be so kind and stay to the limit, not more than 5 pages. Double-spaced, incidentally. You may do some tricks with the margin, but anyhow, 5 double-spaced pages. And I expect that to be in my hands, and Markov knows the date, and you'll get my response to it within 2 days. Thank you, and good luck.
Thank you very much, Johan. I think now you have made it absolutely impossible to criminally expand on the pages and the words.
Well, I hope you have all of this videotaped, Nathal, so that, or taped at least.
It is definitely taped. Video was a bit difficult, but we have it in audio.
Taping audio is enough, so that it can be sent to the participants, because I answered most of the questions you can ask about the transcendental. Thanks for the question. Thank you.
Thank you indeed, Johan. I'm still around for 5 more minutes to answer your questions, dear participants. Thank you very much, Johan, for joining us today.
I myself, I sort of wither away.
Well, wither away he has. Anyone else wants to come in now with comments on the session we've just had? Some questions, some ideas, some proposals. I hope you're all at least satisfied. I tried to touch everyone's questions. Nako, over for now. Everybody else asleep? Nako, over for now.
Nako, Luke here. Sorry, I haven't met you via Skype yet. So I just wanted to ask about the group assignment. Given it's double-spaced and 17 people are writing in for it, how does that work? And I know that it's working through the Galtung Institute, and we all map our progress and perhaps split into teams of 4, covering one team covering US, UK, Turkey, and Israel. But can you talk more about how that works? Look out.
I'm sorry, I just have to laugh, because when Johan presented the topic to me a couple of days ago, the assignment, I was Johan, how is this supposed to work? And he said, that's your problem, not my problem. And then he hung up. So this is going to be sort of a little bit of a creative process. It used to be 10 pages. And then he said, these academics, they like the blah blah too much. I want them to get to the point. So 5 pages should do. Okay. You've said part of what I would suggest is the approach, is that the 17, you know, not all 17 have actually given feedback. We're dealing with 12 people that have shown consistent interest in participating and contributing. So that might be a step towards a solution that we already are dealing with a limited, less expanded number of participants. What we used to do in the past, when I was assistant to Erika de Gortes here, is she would split the groups up into smaller groups, and let us say 2 groups of 6 participants, and have them work out the subject entirely into 2 papers. Now, this probably is not going to be to Johan's satisfaction, because he wants 1 paper, 5 pages. So what we could do, what we usually do, is that we split the team up into the topical dimensions of politics, economics, military, and cultural questions. So if you look at the non-mandatory list of readings, they've been split up according to that method of that framework. Politics, economics, military, culture. So we could perhaps work our way either by forming groups for countries, and let us say 2 people take on Israel, 2 people take on Turkey, Great Britain, and the US, 2 people each for each group, and they work out PEMC, politics, economics, military, culture, or we split the topic into the framework, and we fill it as a group with information from all countries. I have to tell you that I was laughing because I'm a little bit puzzled myself. That is just torture. But maybe the challenge is what this is about for him. Maybe it's to torture us into finding the essentials, with the focus being on therapy. He also said he wants 60 to 80% of the work to be focused not on diagnosis and analysis, but on therapy. I think I'm rambling here. Let me just shut up and let you speak. You all. Do you have some idea of technically getting this together?
Hi, Patrice here. Hello. I was just thinking it might be better to go via country, so then we can look at the politics, economic side, military, cultural side all together, and then create a solution or therapy with all of those in context. That would be my initial thoughts.
Taken. Anyone else? Laura? Haven't said much today. Howard?
Hi, everyone. Natalie speaking. I second Patrice's suggestion just now. So if we take that on board as a template, at least that gives everyone sort of a room to focus on. Not too much, not too little, just about enough. But I don't think too little is a problem here. That's already little as it is. But yeah, so we agreed on a template, and then we split up by country. Natalie, over and out.
Janet, you look very immersed in your thinking how to solve this.
Hi, Nekao. I was thinking, hi, everybody. I was thinking for myself that it would probably be easier to focus on one country and four topics to do with that country rather than then look at four different country case studies, because that's an extremely complex thing to do in the time frame. So I will support Patrice's original suggestion.
So that's, I'm just drafting a sort of table to have a look at what it might look like, and I'll send it to you in a few seconds. Patrice, do you want to continue from there, take it from there, since your suggestion is quite popular?
Hi, Patrice here. Unusual for my suggestions to be popular, would it be best that, you know, each country can sort of take one page each sort of thing, and I'm sure it would be difficult to fit that in. And do we need an introduction and conclusion for this? I'm not sure. Maybe that can be the fifth extra page. Patrice, out.
Nako, with an immediate response, technically what we can do, this is a sort of a proposal to cheat, to keep academic standards, to make sure academic standards are met. If you have quotes and sources, I would say we put that in everything from page 6 onwards, so that we do have sourcing. Otherwise, it's just an essay, and maybe we can lift the level a little if we have sources to back the things you'll be writing. And in addition to what Patrice is saying, here's what I suggest. How about we make it a 100% therapy paper? So it's entirely focusing on remedies to problems that will perhaps have to be mentioned. If one page per country, maybe the first paragraph is, ladies and gentlemen, this is the issue we're dealing with in this realm, and the rest that follows on this one page is therapy proposal. Maybe it should be 100% therapy, and diagnosis and prognosis is the work that we do before writing it up, but we don't write that up. So sources from page 6 onwards, introduction, we leave it out, but we should pen one, and we give Johan the body of the paper without the introduction and without the sources, but the complete paper as such should contain those two elements. Nako, over and out. Hope that was useful.
Hello, Howard here. you can probably see with my glass of red wine. My singular perspective is this. I don't really care if some structure could be imposed on the thinking that we all need to bear on the different situations, that would be perfect. I think we're all capable of thinking from a geographical or a ethical or a indeed logical perspective. It doesn't really matter. But if that could be imposed on us as students, that would be perfect. I'm quite happy grappling with an environmental perspective or a geographical perspective, you know, Turkey versus, you know, Israel. I don't really care what it is. But if we could impose that on the students, that would be fine. And I'm a student, so I'm quite happy to have that imposed on us. So just tell us what we need to do, and we can think from that perspective. Thank you.
Nako here, thank you for that. I mean, this is really mean. I mean, if he had given us at least 2 pages per country, I would feel very comfortable with it. But yes, so what I'm sensing here is 3 problems. Space to expound the ideas and to be elaborative has been cut down. By the way, a very Norwegian thing to do, as I recently learned. I mean, if you've read any of his editorials, this is an anecdote, you'll find that his editorials are 900 words long, and when you've read them, you feel like any reasonable, sensible editor would tell him to make that 9,000 words. But he just breaks it down to 900, and you think, why? Why would anyone want to say so much in such a confined space? But okay, so that's a problem we have, and I would say maybe we don't have to. This is the first time that he's done this, so maybe we don't have to do DPT entirely. Maybe we can just zoom in on specific aspects of the analysis, and as he said, 80% therapy, let's make that 100. So that cuts on what we would have to write about from the beginning. So the whole 5 pages would be entirely therapy. It's a suggestion. A second thing, as you're saying, to impose something is a bit not my style, and Johan won't lend himself to this solution-finding process that he's left us with. Why don't we impose something on ourselves? How about that? And we find out what to do when we impose it on ourselves. It's sort of an easy way out for me.
This is Janet here, and perhaps what he... Oh, sorry. That's perhaps Nakao, the professor, would congratulate you for being creative. I think that's one of the things he was stressing today. Creativity isn't just talking. It's about coming up with seeing something differently.
Well, it doesn't solve the problem.
Laura here. I was thinking that maybe if we can all nominate the country that we would like to work on, and then we can just kind of take it from there, that might make life a little bit easier. For example, I don't really mind, but I'm happy to nominate myself for Turkey. Just saying. Laura out.
Luke here. Can you explain the belligerent formula that's used? I tried to search on Google this afternoon to find some information, and there's probably a link in the material sent out for the class, but I wasn't able to find it at short notice. What struck me, like, why the 4 countries? If I think about the US, the UK, Israel, and Turkey, they've all been the center of the universe at some point in some civilization. Professor Galtung talked about the Ottoman Empire being for Turkey. Israel claims Jerusalem as its capital, and then, of course, London and Washington have more recently been capitals. Is that in the line of thinking? And I know it deals with military, culture, politics, and society. Sorry, I can't remember the third. Luke out.
Thanks for bringing the question up. Yes, the first time Johan mentioned this to me, I was a bit surprised myself years ago, and I asked him, why these four countries and what is this about? And he said the following. He said, at some point, he had a working group before I joined in 2006. They had a working group just look at data from war studies, And the approach they took was, let's have a look at all the data that they have on war studies, on how many countries have been at war, how long they've been at war. And the idea they had was to say, okay, so these are the lists of wars in the world. These are the lists of countries that have been involved in the wars. Let's look at how long have these countries existed, or these entities existed as countries, and how many wars have they been involved in? And let's divide that and have a look. So the number of wars per country since existence. And the criteria of existence was a consistent sort of sense of continuity as perceived by the country itself. So even though Turkey isn't the Ottoman Empire and is a sort of just the nucleus of what the Ottoman Empire used to be, they took Turkey to include the Ottoman Empire, since Turkey has that in its self-ascribed identity. I hope this is making sense to you. So the criteria was, how long has this entity existed as a self-perceived entity? And how many wars has it been involved in? And what came out was this chronology of the leading countries, according to this criteria, among the plus minus 200 countries that we have on this planet today. The leading country, even though it's very young, is the USA, Great Britain, Israel, and the Turkey, including the time Turkey was the Ottoman Empire, were the top four. And I remember reading a paper where Johan had gone into who else was on that list in the top six or something, and I'm trying to find it. I can't find it thus far. But that is what's behind that thought. Did this help, Luke? Hello?
Luke here. Yes, it helps a lot. Thank you. Yeah, it's good.
Of course, it's so that's how that list comes into being. It's I'll have to check whether I find that other paper, but this was done before I joined Transcend and became his assistant, so I've just sort of understood how he gets to that number, and I'll try and find that paper. But he does work with this list from that effort that they did back then, and his problem is that Turkey, for instance, is relapsing into a belligerent regional strategy. Oh yes, and this brings me to something else. Actually, I feel like my hands are very much tied this time around, because we do have a geopolitical approach to analysis, and usually it comprises looking at the neighboring countries of every country that you are studying, because, and this links back to the Taoist approach, let us say you're looking at Turkey. I think Turkey has 13 or 16 neighboring countries. I'm not quite sure, 13, if you count the countries on the other side of the Mediterranean with it. So what we would have to do here is we'd have to look at the relations that Turkey has with its neighbors in a Taoist approach, so that we can tell what Turkey is about from how Turkey exists in the holon that is made up of its neighboring countries and itself. And that would then make... Oh, Janet, you look very comfortable. It's very late where you are. I really have to tilt my hat to you people for your endurance. And I really regret that we're doing this to you. Yeah. So my hands are a little bit tied, because he's really forcing us to define the problems to which we are suggesting therapies ourselves in our research interest. So we have to sort of pick the military realm as a priority, because he focused on the most belligerent four. So I'm feeling that he's not so interested in this paper in politics and economics and culture or environment as Howard brings in ecology, but on how, if we're looking at all these angles, how they impact the criteria of research here, which is belligerence. So let us say Turkey and belligerence and ecology, Howard, would bring in, of course, these negotiations about the rivers and how water is flowing and how that relates Turkey to Israel, for instance. Or in Israel and Syria, how the rivers are, the Golan Heights, for instance. I'm trying to work my way into your ecological perspective for military concerns.
It's Howard here. Sorry to jump in, Nakao, but that's possibly exactly the point, is that the underlying causes of conflict, i.e. water and indeed security, are what drive the conflict that we see over and over again played out in media. That is to say that the vast majority of the media conflict that we see is portrayed in a way that is not reflective of the true reality of what drives the conflict, which is access to water, riparian access to water, and security of a nation state system. So look, Nikhil, thank you for that point, and I look forward to exploring this issue much more over the course of our studies.
Thank you indeed. I'm very envious because you've had wine audibly. I haven't. Hello?
You meant to make a comment or a question?
I was on mute there, so I'm not sure what I was meant to say. Sorry.
Okay, that's just me being envious. Was it red wine or white wine? Or what kind of wine is it?
It's red wine. Hang on, I'm going to show you the wine here. Hang on. Hang on, here it is coming in here. This is Lake's Folly. It's a very nice wine. It's, hang on. Just want to make sure. There, Lake's Folly. So if any of you are aware, it's from the Hunter Valley. It's a New South Wales wine. It's really not that special, frankly. It tastes lovely. And I think that if you have to sit up late at night and listen to some wonderful, intelligent conversation, that you should also recognize the value of people who are passionate about red wine. So there we go.
I feel like if I had a wine right now, Howard, I'd drop asleep at the keyboard. So I commend you.
Okay, give it a go, sister. Next time we'll sit together. And trust me, you can drink a red wine and stay focused. Do it.
Okay, I am looking at the watch. I have 5 more minutes to spare. I have a little table, and that table is saying right now 100% therapy focus. Secondly, perspective is belligerence, and then it has a table with the countries, 1 page each, USA, Great Britain, Israel, Turkey, and it has politics, military, culture, economics, and environment as focuses. We are about 7 or 8 people, and we have to distribute the tasks among ourselves, among each other. We'll have to be in dialogue much. And I think what is being asked of us is perhaps to be monothematic. We just pick one subject and we deliver a short, pointed sort of thing that we want to say something about. Natalie is going for Turkey. Who else is for, who else wants to pick something? Turkey, gone to Natalie. Aha, Janet has Israel.
Sorry, what are the options again? Sorry, Nakao.
You're late. You can't have Turkey anymore. Turkey's gone to Natalie and Laura. Janet has Israel. England is with Patrice. England? Okay. England is with Patrice. You have to pick something. I understand Turkey's gone to 2 participants already. So perhaps that could be, if I can have someone to work on Israel with me, that would be great. Says Janet. My mic is off now. And including...
I will take whatever is left.
So you're for red wine and leftovers. Liz, ich bin gleich da. Ich habe noch 4-5 Minuten mit Ihnen und bin dann da.
That is correct.
Guys, I've just mentioned that unfortunately I'll be offline most of this week, partly because of my location, I'm traveling, but partly because I have extensive job this week where I'm working weekdays but also three of the weeknights. So if anybody else wants to co-attempt Israel, that would be really helpful.
Some participants aren't here anymore, so that will have to go in form of an email. Can I ask someone, one of you, to sort of send this around? I'll send an image around with the names that we have right now for the different countries, and let us hope in a process of quick sorting of participants to topics and themes that the others that are not here anymore will... flock to some regional or topical focus that they like. I'll send you the table that I've drawn up just now. I'll take a screenshot and send it to you in the Skype in the next 3 minutes. It's coming. Mic off. You all can say something, anything about the course so far? How was it today? Any suggestions to improve things? There's an audio coming. I'll send it to you also, ASAP.
Howard here from Australia. I thought the professor was amazing, very impressed, and that was awesome. Just tell us what you want us to do with regard to the specific geographical reasons you want us to work on, and then I'm more than happy to do that.
Okay, I'm typing it in. You know what? I'll just assign you to the USA. Then it's done. Is that okay?
Yes, that's fine.
Oh, but you did say Turkey as well. Didn't you say Turkey? Now that I'm typing your name on the USA, I can remember that a couple of minutes ago you said Turkey. Is that correct?
So, Howard again, Turkey.
Yes, Howard, did you explicitly wish to work on Turkey? If not, I'll let you stay with the US.
I'd probably rather work the US than Turkey. I'm less familiar with Turkey than the US. So Turkey's much less familiar to me.
Okay, perfect. So you're with USA now. Luke, did you say something? Let me check.
England. Oh, I was just going to ask, the US and the UK, as a country, they're one place, but they're spread all across the world. So this may not be relevant to to what we're doing this week, but how do we define the US and the UK?
I think you can just go by national borders and flags in this case, but I know exactly what you're getting at.
Luke here, thank you.
But I mean, in that case, Australia belongs to the same pocket, the Five Eyes pocket.
Right. Yeah, I was just trying to work out the parameters for the assignment. I think I'll work with Janet on Israel if that's okay with the class. Luke out.
Excellent. This is better and better with the minute. I've filled Israel, Janet and Luke, Turkey, Natalie, Laura, Great Britain, Patrice, USA, Howard, and let's just get this over with within the next 2 minutes. off or is it on? Is my microphone off or on? Now it's on. Is anyone else left? Hello?
Laura here, nothing more for me.
This is Howard, nothing more for me. I'm happy to be told what to do. Knockout, it's Howard here. If you could just tell me exactly who I'm meant to be working with, what exactly I'm meant to be preparing for the next session, and then I guarantee you I will deliver that. If you could just tell me exactly what I need to do, thank you. It's been delightful. I am very impressed with the professor's comments tonight. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you all indeed. I have just taken a screenshot now of what you're getting, and it's coming your way.
I'm going to sign off and go to bed too. Luke here, thanks so much for the session this evening. It's fantastic. Luke out.
Just give me a couple more seconds and the image is coming. It's coming. It's coming.
Likewise. Thank you, Nakao. Awesome work. And look forward to speaking to you in soon. Thank you. Bye.
Coming your way, desktop, save it here, and then back to Sport, directly back to Skype, and directly onto attached document, and it's coming your way. Let me have a look. It's not coming your way. Yes, it is coming your way. Let me see. User. God, difficult to find it. Where is it? Desktop. There it is. Bam, bam, sent. You have what it looks like now, and I will work on this. I will simply send this to all the users, and I hope that everyone finds a place in there. I think this is what we had in the last minutes, right?
Laura here, looks good to me. Thank you.
Most welcome. Thank you all. I really enjoyed this. Thank you also to you, Natalie, for staying around so long. I thought I heard some, maybe that was Howard's children, but I heard children, and that's quite enduring. Thank you very, very much. I'll send it around. And Natalie, I'll take care of the advice you gave me to make sure that the reading is more accessible to everybody. Bye-bye. So, ich möchte mich erstmal entschuldigen, dass das so lange gedauert hat. Normalerweise ist der Kurs so angelegt, dass er ausschließlich eine Stunde dauert. Der Kurs ist so angelegt, dass er eigentlich 60 Minuten dauert, nicht mehr. Und diese Teilnehmerinnen haben also sehr,